top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 337 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Dr. Sleep and The Invitation. Now, Jeff is off this week, and I'm looking forward to his return. This week, I decided to take a little bit of a different tack on the podcast here and discuss two films which I believe are somewhat deficient, and yet they represent, I think, ultimately something positive going on in the horror space. So first off, I'm going to reverse the order here, but from 2015 is The Invitation by Karen Kusama. It's a Midwest Japanese-American film director who is best known for Jennifer's Body. I'm going to do a quick shout out here. An ex-colleague of mine is his name is Frederick Bleichert. That's B-L-I-C-H-E-R-T. And he's got a book called Extra Salty, Jennifer's Body, and that's coming out, I believe, from ECW Press, which is a large, though independent, book publisher in Canada here. So looking forward to visiting Jennifer's Body, because I can't say I've ever seen that. It's despite its wide name recognition and whatnot, but it looks to be something that'd be quite enticing, and if The Invitation is any indication, then Kusama's work is something that I should be delving into a little bit more. A caveat, I guess, at the outset is this kind of social convention horror that's best exemplified, I think, through the likes of Get Out, but is also the kind of thing that, let's say, One Bedroom delves into, where you have insider-outsider group dynamics all structured around either a dinner party or some sort of social gathering. I'm not overly keen on this as a conceit around which to base your film, although The Invitation, I think, is quite successful as one of these films goes. So what you have is a gathering, and at the outset, Will and Kira, and they're a young couple, and they're invited to Will's ex-wife's home for a party, and the Will and his ex-wife both lost their young son, and so this dynamic is set up, and the son's demise is brought into focus later on as a way to sort of justify this kind of weird social setup, because unless you're on really, really good terms with an ex-wife, it's probably not your first choice of social destinations, that's for sure. But as it is, Will and Kira are on the road, and they go to this gathering, and what they find there is not as it seems. So again, it's that this is not really my favorite setup for a horror flick, but it's one of those things, and they, you know, find themselves to be trespassers, and forgive those who trespass upon us is, what is it, that Matthew from the Bible? I believe it's that one. But yeah, it's this kind of, when you cross the threshold into another scene, when the house itself is not the the harbinger of doom or not the focus, in the case of, let's say, a hotel in The Shining, or when the structure is imbued with the fear, then something I can more get behind. Also the noted Canadian horror, The Changeling. It's one of those types of films. At this one, there's something going on, and you have a gathering that's led by a fellow who I believe was also in Gerald's Game, so that's going to dovetail nicely with a discussion later as I touch briefly on Dr. Sleep and Mike Flanagan, whose output is a very hit and miss, whether it's the aforementioned Gerald game, which is outstanding and upturns any kind of expectations the viewer may have that it's one of those misery type movies, and it has very few principles but manages to build around that dynamic to a sensational conclusion. And it's just a wonderful effort. And then you have something like his Ouija film or that leaves me a bit cold. So depending on what space Flanagan's operating in, and we'll touch on that later, but when it comes down to the folks that are part of this invitation, they the Will's ex-wife is newly married and living in this sprawling, Frank Lloyd Wright-esque, beautiful California mansion, and everyone who gathers there has some sort of, it's they don't really dwell too much on it, but it's a reunion of sorts among friends. And for the first half of this movie, or let's say the first 30 to 40 minutes, you have a lot of investment in banter and the disparate groups of people, all of whom are have in common the couple who owns this house, and who, it turns out, was recently on a retreat, one of these sort of therapeutic, pseudo self-esteem boosting enterprises that are popular amongst the yuppie ilk, people of this type. And they're so moved by it that they put on this kind of ridiculous video presentation, watching, I guess, septuagenarian, I believe, demise, and saying this outfit that they all belong to made them realize that that it's best not to dwell on the past, and how you could continue going forward without living in a life consumed with grief, which is the type of thing that really resonates with Will's ex-wife here, because, again, they lost a son, and apparently this kind of message, and it's led by this Svengali guru type figure, a Tony Robbins south of the U.S. Mexican border, who peddles all these easy answers, and it's something that she and her friends, really took to, but the folks at the dinner party were not really overly too keen on experiencing it. And this is something the movie addresses right off the bat, as you have Will and Kira, canoodling on the sofa and just surprised by having to watch this bizarre piece of propagandistic footage from this Mexican cult. And it really sticks, drives a stake into whatever kind of fun and lighthearted proceedings were heretofore being enjoyed at this party, and all the wine that was flowing and spilling and that. And this revelation really puts things in a pickle, and is followed by a character by the name of Pruitt, who goes up and says his key learning from this Mexican group was that you could get on with your life and you needn't dwell in the past again. And it's something maybe this is something that really resonated particularly with him, because he conveys the story of how he in effect murdered his ex-wife by hitting her in a drunken rage. Not so much murder, but more on the manslaughter side of things. So he makes this very, very public and very, very stern, intense revelation to the assembled that he struck his wife, she fell down, she hit her head, and something he has to live with for the rest of his life, and it's something for which he's partly paid the price. I think he did about 7 or 8 years in the can. So it's one of these things, it's a bit like David Cronenberg's History of Violence, and whether someone who has a propensity to do that, drunk or otherwise, can really rehabilitate themselves and be no danger to society. And this is a theme that's played up with this group, and how he factors into this group's, the goings-on regarding this group is something. And again, Karen Kusama keeps the viewer guessing. So you have this really whiz-bang and really, really shocking finale that I think really makes up for some of the slowness and some of the awkwardness in the scenes that lead up to it. But credit to her for investing so much amidst numerous bottles of Pinot Grigio poured all over the place in this fancy pants mansion. But the banter between all the characters, it's sufficient to render them all having been relatively well acquainted with one another. And there's some really, really good social dynamic conventions, particularly as it plays out with respect to grieving fathers. And so typically in this kind of movie, what you would have is a setup by which maybe a mother will be grieving the loss of maybe an even younger child than the one in this film, and then maybe have her thoughts taking over and maybe being sucked into whatever evil lurks in some structure or some abode. I think that would be the typical fare. So it was interesting that that Kusama would have the protagonist be a dad and a grieving dad. It really adds a lot to the proceedings. Now, Will, again, the grieving dad, starts to suspect something is amiss with this, the kind of odd behavior. And this shares something a little bit in common with, I would say, Midsommar. But he, one of the friends leaves him a voicemail and was supposed to have arrived at this shindig at a certain time, but didn't. And Will strongly suspects that this group had something to do with his disappearance and failure to show up at the proper time as per a social convention. And Will's suspicion and the rest of his friends giving him a pass over his kind of what would normally be perceived as extremely gruff and a rude behavior is what gives this film another interesting dynamic too, because essentially Will gets a pass for being a dick because he lost his son recently and everyone can appreciate that. So when he comes down hard on the couple for their somewhat cult-like new belief system, this is somewhat tempered by his girlfriend Kira, who has to apologize on his behalf, and a lot of this is an exercise in smoothing things over. And what happens toward the end of this movie, though, is something that it can partly be anticipated, but also throws you a few really, really solid twists. And without spoiling it, it's I think it's something that's pretty incredible, and tests the limits of definitely Christian forgiveness. And the dynamics and social interplay among friends, even good friends, and the things that simmer under the surface, especially when the groups of people haven't associated with one another and the passage of time has maybe changed their personalities and made them not know one another to the extent they think they did. And I think it's 2 or 3 years that's passed since the group of these people have gotten together, and the climax involves some somewhat Jim Jones type of a denouement resolution, but a twist, again, without spoiling it. Really exemplary, fabulous, just unbelievably intense and foreboding atmosphere. And I think with the lead character, Will, even calling out, and maybe the setting of Los Angeles and the Hollywood Hills, and that it conjures up a bit of a Charles Manson type vibe. Probably not helped by the fact that Will, the lead character, looks a bit like young Charles Manson, at least hairstyle-wise, and could probably be a member of Arcade Fire or some awful indie band. The extent to which I think the invitation comes up possibly a little bit short is Will is a character in whom everyone's supposed to invest, and he's maybe not, he's more of a taciturn fellow, and while you don't expect him to be the life of the party, certainly that he could have had a little bit more life to him than what the character is portrayed as. He's not, I mean, looks like maybe a character out of Deadwood too, with the way he's dressed, like some sort of 1860s prospector or something. It's just kind of a weird character, and I think brings the proceedings down a little bit compared to the stunning and quite outstanding ensemble piece that the rest of this is. And again, if you stick around till the end, you're going to be rewarded with something really, really intense, really beautifully shot, using, again, one setting, so this sprawling mansion, and using wonderful tones as well, and oranges, and so well done on that. And a star rating, I think it would probably be about 3.25 for that one, maybe as high as 3.5, depending on how what you think about these kinds of movies, the types of Inside or Out group something lurking behind the surface. Maybe it would be like The Wicker Man or Midsommar or Get Out, although this has no folk elements, unless you want to consider some of what was happening in Mexico folk-like. That's possible. I guess that could be fair. Depending on how you feel about the subset of horror, not my particular favorite, and I have pretty strict reservations about Get Out and Midsommar as well. Although both films had some really, really impactful scenes that, and they really can't be discounted out of hand. Now, Dr. Sleep. Stephen King infamously, or famously, I guess you could say, too, was very lukewarm, quite the opposite to Stanley Kubrick's outstanding The Shining. And he sees Dr. Sleep as a way to have restored the legacy of the original Shining, which it's safe to say he loathed. Now, having not read the book, and put that caveat up front here, it would have been nice to have Jeff on the show, because he actually has and says it doesn't measure up. This is another film that shows that there's a lot of creativity, you know, when it comes to the horror space. And as flawed as this one is, I would take half of this over the paint-by-numbers rote retelling of It or Pet Sematary, which were so pedestrian, you might as well have put on a comfortable pair of walking shoes, because there's so little done with them other than, you know, shoving John Lithgow into the lead and switching up whether the spoiler alert, son or daughter dies at the hands of the or not really the hands, but the of the truck hurtling down the side road. But there's really so little that both It and Pet Sematary add to those particularly iconic and indelible films. That they were, you know, the sobriquet of unnecessary is thrown around a lot, and I think demonstrably so in the case of those two. Well, you can't say that Dr. Sleep, a de facto sequel to The Shining, isn't ambitious. I mean, this thing is extraordinarily ambitious, taking a young Danny Torrance, played by well, not the young one, but as an older man, Daniel Torrance, played by Ewan McGregor, who's looking a little bit worse for wear these days, and putting him in a situation whereby he is finding fellow members of the Club of Shiners. It sounds like Shriners, that subset of Freemasons who parades around in those fez hats. But people who shine, there's also a young girl named Abra, cheekily part of abracadabra, the magician's phrase. And we delve a little bit into the psyche of Torrance as he's grown up to be, understandably, given the circumstances of what happened at the Overlook and all the goings on at room 237, but he's a raging alcoholic and is has basically decamped and picked up from his life. And they get this tale about how he went out to Florida and then returned to New England, obviously Stephen King's favorite locale, and tried to start a new life, picking up some handyman type work with under boss Billy, a man who's similarly had to battle with the booze and who runs this kind of amusement park type thing and gives Danny extra work so that he can get by. Now, he rents a room in this creepy attic of this home, and that's where you get the communiques between him and his fellow Shiner, who it turns out is a preteen girl in a well-to-do biracial family. And we get this dynamic of the two of them coming together and communicating with one another, whilst this evil group that's the antagonists, who are something out of Lost Boys or Near Dark or that kind of thing, this kind of this mysterious cadre, this motley crew of characters out in the woods, led by Rose the Hat, who is, speaking of magicians, a magician who at the outset of the film, in a very creepy scene, pulls a rabbit from her hat and does all these magic tricks regarding springtime and foliage and flowers, and entices a young girl into their fold so that she can be murdered, and that this group who lives on the pain and suffering of others. It's a bit like Hellraiser in that respect. They can feed. Well, yes, so here we go. We got this film that sets up this dynamic where this group has to is pitted up against, or pitted against, actually, rather, these people who have these extraordinarily telepathic abilities, more so in the case of the young girl than actually Daniel Torrance. And he has to give her advice on how she can protect herself and also protect the family from the encroachment of this evil group. And while they're not immortals, they do feast on the blood of the living, and they do suck in their I guess their souls, for lack of a better phrase, and that's how they can live a happy life in a state relatively well preserved. And you get the dynamic of Ewan McGregor's Torrance character teaming up with the initially incredulous Billy, his employer, and this young girl, so they can do battle with their antagonists. And again, this is incredibly, this almost has more in common with, let's say, a Pan's Labyrinth. It has a very, very supernatural, very, very lush, and it's undeniably and unquestionably beautifully shot. The woods are beautifully rendered, as are the homes, just luxurious in its imagery. But again, there's a sag in the middle and a certain sameness and repetition that comes from touching on some of the same, I think later on, too many plot beats that Kubrick introduced us to, whether it's the desiccated and antediluvian ancient a rotting old lady in the bathtub, or whether it's the twins that are, again, these plot beats are hit again and again. I mean, the twins in The Shining have become almost a cliche, and there's also an inclusion of Daniel Torrance living out his trying to exorcise demons through his the sins of his father, really, in revisiting a pivotal moment from The Shining film by actually sidling up to the bar, famously in the Kubrick film, run by a barkeep, Lloyd, and having a tete-a-tete with a Lloyd's surrogate, who actually bears a very, very, very strong resemblance to Jack Nicholson, which adds a certain, I guess, meta layering to this film, and is one of the more impactful moments when you see Torrance come face to face with his abuser, and depending on the extent to which you think he is a sexual abuser in some people's interpretation of the original Shining. You have a somewhat gimmicky and somewhat hokey denouement, which takes place at the Overlook as well, when all the characters have to ultimately do battle, and there's a reprise of the infamous maze, and you even have you have Dick Halloran, Scatman Carruthers, doppelganger, or actually it's just a, you know, his actual character who's apparently living on as someone who shines. And it's just, I didn't think all those plot beats were absolutely necessary, though you have to give it credit where credit is deserved, especially when it came to how this group of quasi-vampires keeps themselves fed and satiated. And there's a couple really impactful demises of young kids that I felt was really particularly arresting and extremely tough to watch, especially when they lure a young baseball player from the Iowa cornfields, who is apparently a budding star who can hit every kind of pitch. They lure this kid into the back of their van and pounce on him and bury him in a shallow grave outside an abandoned factory. There's some really, really brilliantly evocative and just powerfully gut-wrenching moments in this film, but sagging in the middle amidst its supernatural leanings, and overly leaning into, I think, that kind of positioning. And I'm not sure that's quite the way I don't know if I would have taken that hard a supernatural angle, but it really is hard to say. I mean, this has more of a Dead Zone feel than anything else, and really ratchets up the telepathy bit, where and it also explains the origins of Danny Torrance's imaginary friend Tony. So, Shining diehards, and there are a few naysayers, but most people just absolutely love that film, will be somewhat, I think, mystified by this one. And while they'll appreciate the references, there's something that seems a little bit shoehorned in that doesn't quite, this, you know, the some of the parts that don't totally add up. I'm going to give this one probably a 3 out of 5, but again, just the, it shows a real depth of imagination to even conceive of something this elaborate when in the horror space we're frequently saddled with thoroughly unimaginative rehashings of famous properties, whether it's the awful, and it gets awful every year that passes, 2018 Halloween reboot. So this is something you got to give credit where credit's due, and both the and Dr. Sleep are examples of the kind of creativity that is nested within the horror space and is just, you know, aching to come out. A little bit of a free form podcast here as a sort of gathering my thoughts in real time, trying to sort of, I was hoping to get Jeff's perspective on Dr. Sleep because it was something I'd really, really anticipated. But as someone who's seen The Shining so many times, but there's something about the Duval character again, and this sort of mousy look that just can't be replicated by someone just trying to mimic her hairstyle and trying to recreate the iconic axe scenes and that. There's just something a little off-putting about it, and yet when you have the other elements, it you can't help but give credit again where it's due. So 3 solid star rating out of 5 for that. Don't forget to pick up a copy of our book, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, and support the Really Awful Movies podcast by grabbing a copy of our latest celebration of the action cinema. Mine's Bigger Than Yours, the 100 Wackiest Action Movies, which is at bookstores all over the place. Yay, bricks and mortar as we come out of the pandemic. So pick up a copy of that. We'd be really appreciative. And we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.